One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasurer.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and this episode we're bringing you a conversation about coal, climate change and conservatives with former Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull. He was in conversation with our Chief Economist, Richard Dennis, and this was part of our webinar series. It was recorded live on the 27th of April 2021, and things may have changed since recording.
So Australia is the number one exporter of coal in the world and the third largest fossil fuel exporter overall, behind only Russia and Saudi Arabia. Yep, it's not a jobs-intensive industry in this country. Though the Australia Institute's Climate of the Nation national poll every year shows that the Australian public regularly overestimates the size and contribution of coal mining to the Australian economy and to jobs. It was only last week that 101 Nobel laureates from peace, literature, medicine, physics, chemistry, and economic sciences, like so many people around the globe, were talking about this moral issue of our time, climate crisis, and asking world leaders to take really commensurate action to the size of the crisis. And they urged all world leaders to stop the expansion of fossil fuels ahead of the Biden climate summit. So today we're going to be talking about coal, about fossil fuels, about climate change and about conservatives and the politics of it with Australia's 29th Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. Mr. Turnbull has recently been very vocal about the role of the Murdoch media in Australia's climate wars, as well as supporting the Australia Institute's research calling for a moratorium on new coal mine approvals in New South Wales. Thanks so much for joining us today, Malcolm Turnbull.
Yeah, great to be with you, Ebony and Richard. And congratulations to the Australia Institute for the great work it does in this and so many other areas.
Yeah, thank you so much. I wanted to start out by asking you about that research that you talked about with Frank Kelly not so long ago. We looked at the number of coal mine approvals in New South Wales and raised the idea of a moratorium. I know particularly you've been concerned about coal mine approvals in the Upper Hunter. Why is it that you supported that Australia Institute call for the pause on coal mine approvals? And what kind of impact does coal mining have in the Upper Hunter? What's it doing up there?
Well, Ebony, I supported it for the same reason that a very substantial majority of people support it in the Upper Hunter, as evidenced by the polling that was published recently, and that is because it's simply common sense. I mean, we have already about 100 million, there's 100 million tonnes of coal that is being licensed to be mined in the Hunter, that is not being mined and exported because demand is not there, right? So there are mines that are either not operating or operating below capacity. And so any new mine that is going to be open will, by definition, cannibalize the demand of another mine. And so the, you know, it's not as though this is some great burgeoning industry with increasing demand. We know that coal exports are going to decline. They are declining already. There's a whole, we can get into a bunch of reasons for that, but they need to decline, right? I mean, if we keep on exporting and burning, people burning coal, we're not going to achieve our objectives of avoiding dangerous levels of, even more dangerous levels of global heating. So in those circumstances, it makes sense to pause, to have a careful analysis of the situation and in so doing protect existing jobs, but above all, plan the transition to the clean energy future so that people will have good jobs in the years to come. Now, as to the impact of coal mining on other industries. Well, it's devastating, obviously. I mean, you've got air pollution. The worst air quality in New South Wales is in Muswellbrook, right there in the heart of the coal country. That town is basically surrounded by open-cut coal mines. It's devastating for agriculture, for horse breeding, for viticulture, for tourism. I mean, it's leaving a lunar devastated landscape, and there isn't even there isn't even adequate funding made available by the mining companies to rehabilitate the land that they have so terribly devastated. I mean, it's difficult to imagine an industry that does more damage to the environment than open-cut coal mining. It literally digs the whole environment up. And, you know, to anyone who hasn't seen it, you can obviously see it if you visit the Hunter, but just have a look at it on a map on, you know, Google Earth, or, you know, the maps in on your iPhone, and you'll see it. It is just, it's staggering what has been done. And the attitude of the state government, per medium of the Deputy Premier, John Barilaro, is that anybody who does not support the unconstrained, unrestricted, continuous expansion of open-cut coal mining in the Hunter Valley is a heretic. I mean, it is literally this crazy. It's an utter abdication of responsibility and leadership.
I wanted to ask as well, you've talked about obviously the impact that it has on other industries, and you've talked a little bit about how, because all these approvals are going ahead, it's kind of stopping other investment. Can you just talk us through some of those impacts?
Yeah, because, well, look, I should say, Lucy and I own a farm in the Upper Hunter, quite close to, you know, near Aberdeen. So we obviously have a good understanding of the local impact. I'd say, well, you know, essentially, it's like it is really threatening the future of, say, the, just give you one example, the thoroughbred breeding in the Upper Hunter. Now, you know, the Upper Hunter and that Scone area is the second largest thoroughbred breeding centre in the world outside of Kentucky. The Scone Veterinary Clinic is the largest veterinary clinic in the Southern Hemisphere. You know, you're talking about, you know, an industry, industry worth billions of dollars. And these are high quality jobs, highly skilled people. It's an industry that's going to be around forever. I mean, people have been racing horses for thousands of years, and I imagine they'll be doing it in another 1,000 years, but they're not going to be burning coal. And so, you know, the what is basically happening is that an industry that is on the way out and that is threatened by, you know, decline in coal demand and for profoundly good environmental reasons, is putting at risk industries and industries that will be with us forever, you know, growing food and fiber, growing grapes, you know, breeding horses, breeding cattle, etc. You know, it's a shocking abdication of responsibility. And the problem is there's no plan. You know, what people expect governments to do, and I might say to those who say, why didn't you sort this out when you're prime minister, this is absolutely state government responsibility. I mean, the federal government's levers in this area are tiny, if existent at all. So, but what do people expect governments to do is to look over the horizon, plan ahead, and, you know, just manage affairs so that people, you know, people's jobs are protected today and into the future. And that just isn't happening. I mean, it's like the Sydney Morning Herald hasn't written many favourable editorials about me over my many decades in public life, but this was one thing where they said, described what I had said, which is echoing the Australia Institute's recommendations, as sensible, you know, and recommendations that should be taken up. But it's what's happened is that on the sort of right of politics, you have had coal has become fetishized. And instead of us looking at coal and global warming in an objective way and treating it as a question of physics, or as I used to say when I was PM, engineering and economics, it's become an issue of ideology and identity. And, you know, that's part of the problem. And it's that horrible, toxic combination of, you know, right-wing politics, right-wing media, mostly owned by Murdoch, and the fossil fuel lobby. And they just keep on feeding and supporting each other, as, you know, as you know, I've experienced over the years from them. You know, it's but it is, it's hugely damaging. And it's now got us in the position, of course, where we are absolutely out of step with the rest of the world, other than places like Russia and Saudi Arabia, and thoroughly out of step with the administration in Washington.
Absolutely. Richard, before we move on to perhaps some of those bigger issues, I noted there was another coal mine approval just in the last few days. Is that right?
Yeah, look, I'm actually up in the Upper Hunter at the moment. We've got the magic of a screensaver behind me. But, yeah, look, I was in Muswellbrook yesterday, and I echo what Malcolm just said. And thanks so much for coming on, Malcolm. It's great. Have a look. I encourage people, go to Google Maps and look for Muswellbrook, and then just kind of zoom out a little bit and have a look how the whole town is surrounded literally by coal mines. And, you know, there's a beautiful named mine up there, Mount Pleasant. And I assure you that on a windy day, living anywhere near Mount Pleasant is anything other than pleasant. But, yeah, up in the Upper Hunter where they get the vast majority of the air pollution, they get the vast devastation of their agriculture and other industries. As you said at the beginning, Ebony, there's not actually a lot of jobs in the mines themselves. But worse, when you see an approval like we saw yesterday at Mangoola, another enormous coal mine, and you know, to be fair, the Planning Commission effectively accepted all of the Australia Institute's evidence. It accepted that the claims made by the proponent had exaggerated employment effects, exaggerated royalty effects. They, you know, to be fair, they kind of agreed with all of our economic analysis of how exaggerated the benefits would be. And then in a classic case of the operation went well and the patient unfortunately died, they recommended the mine get built anyway. Yeah, you know, here we are kind of stuck in this bizarre situation where we've got the equivalent of 23 new Adanis worth of new coal mine applications heading to the New South Wales government, and the so-called planning process doesn't actually have a plan. Each of these mines, every single one, is evaluated separately, is evaluated individually. And the question is never asked, what would happen if all of them were built? Who would buy the coal? What would happen to air quality in the Upper Hunter, which is already the worst in New South Wales? Would all of that coal fit onto the railway lines? Would all of that coal fit out of the port? Because each mine in the so-called planning process, because each mine is actually evaluated separately on its own exaggerated merits, it's actually beyond the current planning process to say what is in the best interests of the Hunter. And again, as Malcolm said before, right now, absolutely right now, there's 100 million tonnes of spare capacity in the New South Wales coal mines. That is the approved capacity. The amount of coal they said they're approved to mine is 100 million tonnes bigger than what they're currently extracting. So when you approve a new mine like Mangoola into that, it's not going to lead to more exports. It's not going to lead to more jobs. If that mine actually goes ahead, if that expansion and production goes ahead, it's just going to cannibalise output from somewhere else. This is literally economics 101, but in the culture war that is Australian climate policy, you have to barrack for coal in the same way that you barrack for Ford versus Holden, or you barrack for New South Wales over Queensland. It's not economics, and it's certainly not in the interest of the people in the Upper Hunter. But if politics is a tribal blood sport, then, yeah, as we've seen over a decade in Australia, barracking for coal is a powerful thing to do in Australia.
Okay, Ebony, can I just reinforce what Richard said? I mean, this piecemeal approval process is right at the heart of the problem. The fact is there isn't any planning. That's the bottom line. The Mount Pleasant mine, for example, you know, thoroughly inaptly named, was actually approved in, I believe, 1999. It belonged to Rio, I think, at that time. They did nothing with it. They wasn't economic, and it didn't get underway until relatively recently, I think about 2015, 2016. And now they're seeking to expand it yet again. In the meantime, it was sold to a company called Mac Energy, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of an Indonesian family group, the Salim Group. And so, but in the meantime, following the approval of Mount Pleasant, a whole number of other mines were approved and got started being operating and being expanded in and around Muswellbrook. And so, what nobody ever did was actually say, hey, let's look at this area and ask ourselves, how much open cut coal mining do we want? It was just literally approval, everything done in isolation. And this is our environment. This is the world's future, you know, in terms of the emissions, but it's also the amenity and health of people who live in the area. So, you know, it essentially what the Australia Institute has recommended and what I've called for is really no more than common sense. It's just asking government to do its job. But that's that. Those people in the Upper Hunter have been abandoned, believe me. If you listen to Barilaro and the Daily Telegraph, they'll tell you that the only thing that matters is more coal mining. So the more of the valley they can rip up, the better. And then at the end of it, what's going to be left? Is there the money to rehabilitate it? No. What's the landscape that miners want to leave? These enormous voids, and a void meaning a huge hole in the ground. What's that going to be filled up with? What's that going to do to the water table, to the environment? I mean, the whole idea of leaving the landscape more or less as it was when you found it, when you started, that seems to have been abandoned. So who pays for that cost? I'll tell you, the only people that pay are the people of that area, you know, in particular. So it's I guess all that, you know, we've been asking for, and, you know, the independent candidate, Kirsty O'Connell, is asking for, is just a bit of responsibility to protect jobs and protect the environment and build a prosperous future.
I want to come back now, because I think that touches on a point that you made earlier about that this is driven by ideology and some of the problems within politics. You have spoken in the past, or quite recently, I guess, about the role of the Murdoch media in driving a lot of that, I guess, division. Can you just talk to me a little bit about the impact that you think that the media has had on our discourse, and how in particular it's affected the conservative side of politics?
Well, before I do that, we just got to put a footnote to the use of the term conservative. I do not, the sort of Trumpian right-wing populist agenda is not conservative. I mean, Donald Trump was not a conservative. You know, Barnaby Joyce is not a conservative. You know, the conservatives respect institutions. They seek to effect change gradually. They respect the environment. I mean, Margaret Thatcher was a, you know, great advocate of taking action on global warming many years ago. She was, after all, a chemist originally, you know, in her professional training. So conservative, you know, what you're seeing in this sort of what you best described as populist authoritarianism is not conservative. It's not conservatism. As I often say, most of the people who call themselves conservatives nowadays wouldn't know the difference between Tony Burke and Edmund Burke. You know, let's just use that term with care. Okay. The role of the Murdoch press, well, it's massive. I mean, it basically operates as a force of propaganda. It's no longer a conventional or traditional news organisation. Of course, they do report news stories, but they are utterly uninhibited in misrepresenting the facts and pushing a particular agenda. So they run vendettas against people. They often run them against me. That's not the reason I object to Murdoch. I think Murdoch has done enormous damage to Western democracy and indeed to the world, but because he is the single largest amplifier of, if you like, climate inaction in the English-speaking world. And of course, if you look at the United States, Fox News has been the single largest promoter of the lies and the divisive rhetoric that had its culmination in the January the 6th attack on the US Capitol. So, you know, you can say without any fear of contradiction, and, you know, at least from objective people, and James Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, endorsed me when I made this point the other day on CNN, the Murdoch has been doing the work of Vladimir Putin. I mean, Putin's disinformation campaigns are designed to divide Western democracies, particularly the United States, exacerbate existing divisions and create new ones, and to undermine trust in the, you know, institutions of government. That's exactly what Murdoch has done. Now, and we saw the upshot on the 6th of January. If you go around and tell people again and again that Joe Biden didn't win the election, right, even though that's utterly untrue, and you will get enough people to believe that, and then you get the attack on the US Capitol. Now, you know, ultimately, we've got to call this out, and it's had a terrible impact on the United States. It's really done this division in American society, and the hatred that's been spawned by it has done so much damage to the US, and we've seen echoes of that, not to the same extent in Australia. So, you know, the problem is they're in great denial. And I mean, you saw, and even the people that they bully are forced to deny. You know, I thought one of the most poignant moments recently when the Telegraph and News were, you know, campaigning, furiously objecting to my being chairman of a advisory committee on the net zero transition. Apparently the qualification for that is to be a supporter of unconstrained expansion of coal mining, which is rather odd, you would agree. But anyway, so that, you know, ferocious pressure was put on the government, and they buckled, and, you know, my appointment was withdrawn. I mean, I wasn't heartbroken, I might say, but I was only agreed to do it as a favour for Matt Keane. But poor old Matt, having been beaten up by News, then had to go on Sky News and say, oh no, the pressure from News Corporation and the Telegraph had nothing to do with it. Mm. So it really was like somebody that is, you know, beaten up by a crooked cop, and until they sign a fake confession, and the last line of which is, I confirm I have done so of my own free will and without any threat. I know, and I might just make this observation, that the News in their, you know, counterattacks against me say, this is all because I resent, you know, I blame my removal as Prime Minister on News Corp. They played a big role in it. There's no doubt about that. But that's not the point. My criticism is not what happened in August 2018. My criticism is about much bigger issues that go to our, you know, our safe continued habitation of this planet, global warming and our response to it, and the way in which they are undermining, Western liberal democracy. And there's, if you think the United States is just such a good example, bad example, of what I'm talking about. So we can't be blind to this. We can't allow ourselves to be bullied out of this by people that are literally undermining our environment and our democracy for reasons. Let's assume they're just commercial reasons. Let's make that concession. That's no defense, right? If you are a drug company and you are selling drugs that hurt people, it isn't a defense to say, oh, I was just trying to make money. I mean, people have to be responsible for their actions and we have to hold them to account.
Malcolm, I guess I want to follow up on that. I mean, there's still a lot to talk about with all things coal and climate, but, you know, you raise such an – and I agree with your premise about the role of Rupert Murdoch personally and the Murdoch media internationally. There's no doubt about that. But I guess my question to you is, to what end? Like, what is the actual game here? I mean, powerful media proprietors aren't new. Powerful media proprietors have played a shaping role in Australia. You know, no one thought Kerry Packer was a shrinking violet. Mm. You know, but Rupert Murdoch is clearly different. Is he just bigger, or is he playing quite a different game? And if he is, what is that game? What is his objective?
Well, I mean, he's essentially monetized a market for crazy. Okay, so the. You know, he's found a abandoning all responsibility other than to himself and to his, you know, his own profitability. He's, if you like, you know, appealed to, instead of appealing to the better angels of our nature, he's appealed to the worse angels of our nature. And does he sincerely believe in some of the, I mean, did he sincerely believe Joe Biden had stolen the election? Who knows? But that's what Fox News was saying. That's what it was trumpeting. I think he is essentially now a climate denier, but the, you know, I remember years ago, like 15 years ago, Rupert was professing to take global warming seriously, But I think one of the things that people often misunderstand about power is that they assume that people seek power for a purpose. Now, as it happens, I did. I mean, I've been associated with powerful people most of my life, and I've always felt power without purpose is pointless. But for many people in politics and in the media, power turns them on in for its own sake, right? So asking somebody why they want to be powerful, have a powerful job, is like asking somebody why they like sex. You know, it's literally a turn on. And so that's why. So why did Murdoch support Trump as relentlessly as he did, even though he knew Trump was not fit to be president? And I know that because he told me that, you know, before Trump was the Republican nominee. And I mean, everyone in New York who knew Donald Trump knew that, right? So, but he saw this was a guy he could put into the White House who would be deferential to him, take his calls, that would be, he would have power and access. And that was what it was about. Now, the problem is, you know, we ended up with 4 years of Trump and all of the damage that was done, you know, as a result. So I'm not advocating censorship or anything like that, I hasten to add. The first thing we've got to do is make people take responsibility for this and call it out. And, you know, when you get the sort of gaslighting that you get from people who say, oh, we're not climate denialists, well, give me a break. You know.
Well, perfect segue to my next question then. I mean, sure, Rupert Murdoch might have figured out how to cash in on crazy, but he doesn't have a monopoly on it.
No, of course not.
Just earlier this week, you were sitting on Q&A with Andrew Liveris, who Scott Morrison appointed to lead his COVID recovery task force. You know, sounds like a very important job, helping the Prime Minister grapple with the big issues of recovery. Of course, that task force has given us the so-called gas-led recovery at a time where the rest of the world's thinking about renewable energy. But sitting on stage with you, he made the assertion that the gas feedstock industry, the gas that goes into making plastic, the gas that goes into making fertiliser, created 850,000 jobs. Now, you know, I pride myself on my knowledge of the Australian Bureau of Statistics labour force stats, and I instantly realised he was suggesting that that's about as many people as work in the entire manufacturing industry. Now, you challenged him on that, and he stuck to his crazy guns. Now, the Australia Institute's the biggest number we can come up with, like being as generous as we can, the biggest number we can get to is maybe 16,000 people. 16,000 people might, at a stretch, be employed by the fertilizer and plastics industry. But he doubled down when you challenged him on 850,000.
Yeah, look.
What's going on?
Well, look, firstly, Andrew Liveris is not crazy, right? He's a very smart guy. And, you know, look, someone I respect, okay? And he's a personal friend, but I put that to one side. He's a very smart guy. He's anything but crazy. However, that doesn't mean he was right. He was absolutely wrong. I mean, he said there were 850,000. He said there's 850,000 Australians employed by industries that use gas as a feedstock, right? That's what he said. So I challenged him and I said, where are the 850,000 jobs that use gas as a feedstock? And Andrew said, fertilizers, plastics, chemicals, explosives. And I said, there are 850,000 people working in Australia making plastics. Andrew said, yes, yes. I said, is that right? He said, not plastics, all those industries I just said. So fertilizers, plastics, chemicals, explosives. And I said, I don't think that's true. And he said, I can send you the data, and told me that he got the information from the same people who used to do my research when I was prime minister. Well, I hope that's not the case, because it's clearly wrong. So the fact is that the 860,000 is the number of people who work in manufacturing in Australia, and the vast majority of manufacturing jobs in Australia do not use gas as a feedstock. So, you know, this is a, this now, you know, I assume Andrew or somebody will correct this at some point, but it's very misleading. I mean, you know, I'm happy to accept that just about every manufacturing industry in Australia uses energy. I'm sure they all do, other than maybe somebody who's hand making, you know, furniture by hand. But the fact is that gas is a feedstock. Is essentially used, well, by the industries he nominated, but they do not employ 860,000 people. And you say you think it's about 16,000, which sounds about right.
Yeah, but so I agree. I'm not suggesting he's unintelligent, but that assertion that he made is demonstrably wrong. He's been appointed by the Prime Minister to lead our recovery. Now, he's either spent 12 months being completely confused about how many people are involved in the gas feedstock industry, or he went on a program and misled 250,000 people.
I can only assume he was flustered and misspoke. I mean, I'll cut him. He's a friend. I'll cut him every bit of slack I can, but I'm not going.
I can't say that
something that is untrue is true, and what he said was wrong, right?
But I guess where I was heading was, as Ebony said at the beginning, every time we survey Australians, they massively overestimate the number of people who work in coal. They massively overestimate the number of people who work in gas. The average Tasmanian thinks one in five people in Tasmania work in forestry, when the answer is closer to 1 in 100. Mm. So it's not an accident the Australian public thinks so many people work in coal, thinks so many people work in forestry. And it's not an accident, I would suggest, that increasingly people think that without gas, you know, the sky will fall. So I guess my question to you is, how do we kind of challenge this? Is it the role of the media? Because the ABC is owned by Rupert Murdoch, but they didn't correct that yet.
No. Well, I mean, that's right. There wasn't a headline, you know, Liveris misspeaks on gas, or, you know, Liveris wrong on gas, where you can imagine if I'd put out a number that was egregiously wrong, they would have reported that with great prominence. look, I think you just have to call it out. I think there's no substitute for that. But you know, one of the problems is that there isn't. Let me step, go up a little bit in terms of generality. I think that one of the problems we've got is what has been described in the US as the truth deficit. And you might just say that's a fancy way for saying lies. Maybe it is. But essentially what you've got is people in public life and in the media no longer caring about the accuracy of what they say. So they are prepared to lie, deliberate. So that's to say, state something which is a fact, state something as a fact which they know is not so, but they're also reckless about whether what they say is correct. So it is, and increasingly the media is just basically letting it go through to the keeper, and if anything, applauding the more plausible lies as good political tactics. Mm. Now, you know, I'm not trying to, I'll just give you a very personal perspective on this. All the time I was in politics, I was extremely anxious, as anyone who worked with me will recall, about getting my facts straight. You know, so, I mean, I was, as particularly as Prime Minister, you're asked questions on everything, you know, and you can't have every fact and figure in your head. And so I was always anxious that I wouldn't, simply, you know, perfectly innocently, mistakenly get a number wrong. And when I did, I would correct it, right? I don't think there is any longer, I don't see any sign that there is any care about that. And I mean, I have to be honest with you, you know, a lot of my colleagues and advisors thought I was somewhat too fastidious, too fussy about this. And they'd say, oh, well, you know, that's just the old lawyer in you coming out. Because obviously if you start your professional career as an advocate, you know, getting facts wrong in court can have some pretty fatal and humiliating consequences, particularly for your client. So, but I think getting the facts right is absolutely critical. And this is what we've got to be prepared to call out, you know. So that's why, you know, this is what I mean. I wasn't trying to be disagreeable with Andrew, but just that what he said was factually wrong. Mm. No question about that.
We're going to go to questions from the audience very shortly, but I mentioned in my introduction that 101 Nobel laureates had called on world leaders to sign a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. The founder of the Grameen Bank Nobel Peace Prize winner, Muhammad Yunus, tried to send this question into you on Q&A, but didn't quite manage it. So if it's all right, I'm just going to play this video question from him quickly. Okay. and see your response to that.
101 Nobel laureates have just addressed a letter to 40 global leaders, including Prime Minister Scott Morrison, regarding the expansion of fossil fuel. Australia still has some 23 applications for coal mines waiting for approval. Would this panel support the approval of these 23 coal mines? If not, would it recommend any other alternative action? Thank you.
So basically that was, 101 Nobel laureates asking to stop the expansion of fossil fuels and to sign on to that non-proliferation treaty. What would your response be?
Well, I think obviously you need to have an agreement, because you can understand if, let's say you were to stop exporting coal from Australia tomorrow, people would say, well, if you do that, they'll just export more from Indonesia and Colombia and South Africa and so forth, and that would probably be true. But so you need to have a global agreement. There's no question about that. But we do need to recognise, and this is the point John Kerry's been making, that you can't keep on tippy-toeing around this issue of coal and gas. I mean, the only way to cut greenhouse gas emissions effectively, well, not there are other things we've got to do as well, but the most important thing we've got to do is stop, you know, digging carbon out of the ground and putting it into the atmosphere. I mean, that's the objective. And as far as the new coal mines, you know, in Australia, my view is the same as Richard's and yours, that, you know, we shouldn't be expanding coal mining in Australia. It doesn't make any sense at the moment. Even if you thought climate change was a hoax, right? It doesn't make any sense to be expanding mines when existing mines are operating under capacity, because all you're going to do is have new mines putting other mines out of business. And I mean, I think an important thing to bear in mind is particularly all mining, particularly open cut mining, it's not like opening a milk bar where you can say, okay, Fred wants to open a milk bar. I don't think it's a great idea, but anyway, he can open it. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, well, he'll lose some money and, you know, so what? You know, free enterprise. The problem with mining is that it has a huge impact on the environment. And so there is a social cost and an environmental cost that is borne regardless of whether the mine is successful or not. And in fact, if it is unsuccessful and is, quote, mothballed or put on care and maintenance, more often than not as a means of postponing the rehabilitation obligation, then you get the worst of all worlds. You get miners don't have jobs, you know, the environment is damaged, rehabilitation doesn't occur. I mean, it is, so it's very different. It needs much greater thoughtful planning than, you know, say other areas of the economy where you can say, you know, let people do their best and succeed or fail as they, as, you know, events dictate.
I'm going to go to questions from the audience now. The first one here is from Tom Swan, who says, the government's plans to subsidise the expansion of the fossil gas industry, which have been criticised or rejected by economists, unions, industry groups, AEMO, and even some major gas companies. So his question is, in the face of such criticism and including pressure from the Biden administration to end fossil fuel subsidies, what's your opinion on why the government is still pursuing these subsidies to the gas industry?
Well, I've got to assume it's largely political. In order to be seen to be supporting fossil fuels of one kind or another. I mean, really, there is a massive risk in subsidising gas infrastructure right now because it is likely to have a relatively short life, you know? You're just going to end up with a bunch of stranded assets, in other words. It's very, very dangerous. It's a point I made on Q&A. Are we really going to be burning gas at higher levels than we are today in 10 years' time? I don't think so. I can't imagine any scenario. I mean, you know, a really good example of the politicisation of this is the Australian Energy Market Operator, which has done some outstanding work in its field. Had a report recently which forecast demand for gas. And they basically made the point that going out to 2030, unless you have gas available at $4 a gigajoule or less, which is not realistic, and you have the cost of the electricity to pump water uphill, you know, for pump storage, being higher than $30 a megawatt hour, and it's available regularly now on the East Coast market already at considerably less than that. Unless you have that, gas is not going to compete with pump storage or indeed with batteries, because the same batteries, like pump storage, obviously have to draw electricity in to charge them. That's I think at page 55 or so of the report. Now, as we know, Angus Taylor rang up the chief executive AEMO, Audrey Zibelman, and pressured her to change that report. Now that's terrible. You know, I mean, I must say, I would have been staggered if a minister in my government tried to lean on an independent agency like that to change, you know, a factual conclusion, you know, of that kind. I mean, it's just, it is, it's, it's, it's extraordinary. And to Audrey's great credit, she didn't buckle to it. But, you know, a lot of people would, by the way.
Ebony, this is
profoundly wrong.
Sorry, Richard.
In New South Wales, Malcolm was talking about the Environment Minister before, Matt Keane. There's this enormous investment in New South Wales in the so-called renewable energy zone. And, you know, the minister, the Environment Minister, the Energy Minister's explanation for this renewable energy zone is we need to build all this renewable energy for the simple reason it's the cheapest form of energy. And, you know, he was on Four Corners saying that 2 or 3 weeks ago. So here we have the New South Wales government saying renewables are just cheaper than gas. That's why we're expanding them. But we've got the same state government and our federal government saying we think gas is going to be cheap. Well, let's look at what they're doing. Let's look at what the market's doing. The reason that people are moving towards renewables and storage is they're cheap. And this idea from Scott Morrison that technology will fix it, well, you know, as Malcolm knows, Snowy 2.0, the technology of the dam was invented quite some time ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's really not a radical new thing, the dam. No. And you can store a lot of energy in there. So this idea that we're going to have to wait for new technology, the Snowy Hydro, built in the 50s, is the biggest storage facility in Australia, and we don't need to invent concrete or dams or, indeed, pumps. We know how to do that, and we're doing it right now.
Well, interestingly, pump storage is the way about 95% of all the stored electricity in the world is stored, by the way. But you know, hopefully other forms of long-duration storage will become more and more available and competitive and so forth. We do need to build more pump storage, absolutely. But, you know, pumped hydro is over 100 years old. I mean, my recollection is the first pumped hydro scheme was in Europe, started in 1907. Someone on the call might be able to correct me on that, but it's it's not rocket science, but you have to actually get on and do it. And so the good thing about Snowy 2 is that it's actually being built. Now, there's just not enough additional storage being built. I'm glad the GenX project in Queensland looks like it's going to get built, but there just isn't enough else happening. You know, the Battery of the Nation plan, which was again an initiative of my government, hasn't been very little done on that. Nothing's been built yet, you know, and there's governments have got to plan ahead, as I did, recognize we were going to need quite a lot more long duration storage, and then hook in and build it. And, you know, just going around and saying, oh, we're waiting on technology. We've got the technology now to move to a zero emission energy reality. We have that. I'm sure it will get better on the way, but you know, we're not like Mr. Micawber in a hopeless, hapless situation saying something will turn up. We've got the tools we need to do the job are at hand.
The next question that I've got is from Steph Ray. She says, how can future prime ministers make a change with fossil fuels when factions within their parties answer any attempt for change with leadership spills? And I might add, there's just a couple more questions in there along the same lines about how to get that dominance of the fossil fuel industry kind of reduce its political power.
Well, the answer is it's quite hard. It's very hard, in fact. I was hoping, you know, after Morrison was elected, for example, re-elected in 2019, I was hoping that he would reinstate the National Energy Guarantee. He'd certainly supported it while I was PM. And I thought, you know, now that I was off the scene and he had more political capital than just about any Liberal leader could imagine. But, you know, Scott didn't do it. And now, you know, the reason is he does not want that toxic coalition of the Murdoch media, you know, and their fellow travellers, you know, such as 2GB, the fossil fuel lobby and the right wing of the party to do to him what they did to me. You know, all the time I was in politics, my most ferocious opponents were not on the Labor side. You know, they were occasionally critical, but my real opponents were internal. And this is the thing: I think the coalition's got a profound structural problem. It's being held hostage by a group, I call it a coalition. You know, I mean that the LNP, if you like, is being held hostage by a coalition on the right, which is part of an ecosystem that is very, they're deadly and they operate like terrorists in the sense that they don't care if they're prepared to blow the joint up to get what they want, as they've demonstrated. And I know, you know, it's easy for people, particularly on social media, to say, oh, you know, you should have more courage, stand up to them. Well, you know, I've done that a few times, but ultimately, if you end up not being prime minister, you can't do anything. It's easy. You know, politics is hard, and most people who comment on it don't understand it. That's not a criticism. I don't understand, plumbing. I don't understand heart surgery. You know, politics is a craft, and the people that understand it best are the people that have been in it. It is very, very, it's very hard. And you've got to try to bring people with you. And they might be people who are completely unreasonable. But ultimately, if they are prepared, if they're not prepared to compromise, and they're prepared to say, we will blow the joint up unless you do what we want, then you get the sort of stasis that we have at the moment, you know, where we're just, and how stupid does Australia look now? You know, I mean, the frustration with Australia in Washington is so intense right now. It is, I mean, the White House was briefing against the Morrison government recently. I mean, I've never seen that happen before. That was a brief to basically every media outlet here. I don't know who the spokesman was or spokeswoman who was who did it, but their frustration is they look at Australia and they say, cripes, you've got fantastic solar resource, you've got fantastic wind, you've got great scientists and technology. Why are you not getting on board this whole clean energy agenda? I mean, the points that Ross Garnaut makes are absolutely well made. And people look at us from around the world and they say, you're caught hostage by this crazy politics. Why can't you break out of it? And I mean, that's the big question.
Very hard. We've probably only got time for a couple more questions here. So following on from that, there's another question here from Hannah Shook.
Yeah.
I'm pronouncing that name incorrectly. I'm sorry, Hannah. Do you have any practical tips for advocating against new coal, oil, and gas within a conservative government? And I guess I just wondered if you could reflect on the fact that perhaps the state governments and state Liberal governments seem to be a lot more progressive than the federal coalition government at the moment. Is there any kind of hope there for some change?
I think the state Liberal governments are more progressive. There's no doubt about that. Although the recent, events surrounding coal in the Upper Hunter would make you feel that progressivism is pretty thin and not very resilient, if you like, in the face of the pressure from the, you know, coal loving lobby. I think the arguments are essentially rational ones. I mean, you know, this is the problem. If we were dealing with this as a rational issue, we would be doing all the things that we're recommending. I mean, do you want cheap electricity? Renewables plus storage. Do you want to save the planet and cut emissions? Renewables plus storage. Export coal demand is declining and will continue to decline. That's inevitable. So why don't we just recognize that and plan for the future? That's common sense too. But you see, you come up against people that are not having a rational argument. I mean, there's a passage in my book about a meeting held in my office with some of the coal lovers who were trying to persuade me to spend $5 billion on a new coal-fired power station. And I went through the economics of it with them. And, you know, people can read it in the book. But, I mean, there was a very touching moment at the end, and it was clear they weren't satisfied with what I was saying. As they filed out, Bridget McKenzie was there, and she hung back. She was then the deputy leader of the Nats. And she said, "There's no point talking about the numbers with them, PM. They're not interested in that. It's religion."
Mm.
And therein lies the problem. That's the fundamental problem. It's been fetishized into something that should be objective, into a religious thing. I mean, I'm not against coal or for solar. I mean, I'm coal, gas, solar, wind, batteries, pumped hydro are all things or processes. They have certain physical characteristics. And so you've got to say, what do we want to achieve? Well, presumably lower emissions, cheaper energy, and reliable energy. Well, we can do all of that with renewables plus storage.
Yeah. Sorry, we've only got time for probably one question left, and it's from John Cook, and he says, how can the very high levels of subsidy to coal and gas production be limited? And, Richard, I wondered if I could bring you in on this one. I believe there's plans to expand the NAIF and what it's able to subsidise. Can you just speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, and thank you, Ebs. I mean, Malcolm, you were just saying that, you know, there's this sort of religious sort of zeal for some in the Liberal National Coalition for coal. Yeah. Historically, people accused the Liberals of having a religious zeal for free markets. And from my point of view as an economist and someone very interested in politics, and I wrote a quarterly essay about this, that fossil fuels creates this incredible collision between alleged free market zeal and religious zeal for coal, and where that manifests itself is this incredible support for subsidies, you know, for fossil fuels from a party that tends to say in every other sphere, leave it to the market. So with new proposals, like there's amendments for the NAIF, the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility, you know, yet again being touted as a way to get new gas and possibly coal projects up. How do you explain this religious zeal for coal that's so great that it makes otherwise free market Liberals kind of abandon their previous religion?
Well, I think the sort of the populist politics of the right no longer take free market, you know, economics very seriously. I mean, the you know, it's all about, you know, all too often big government and intervention. So, you know, heavy-handed regulation. I mean, that's the tendency there. This is one of the reasons why I say people on the right who call themselves conservatives genuinely aren't conservatives. But there's an old friend of mine, a politician in the region, who has a great saying about politics. He says, "We all know what we need to do. We just don't know how to do it and get re-elected." And I think that the reality is that much of what I've said would be agreed to by many people in the coalition. I mean, very many. But they know if they were to repeat it or endorse it, they would get the sort of treatment Matt Keane got, remember, from the Daily Telegraph a year or so ago, when he gave a perfectly conventional speech about energy policy and the, you know, the impact of global warming on bushfires. And, you know, I remember there was like, it was like a really personal, nasty sort of attack on him. And that was basically a message to say, if you step out of line, this is what you'll get. And so people look at that and they say, I don't want that. I can't live with that. And so that thuggery works. So that's the reality. That's why it's very important for people that are not in elected office, like myself and yourselves, to be prepared to speak up, because sadly, the dynamic, particularly in the coalition, is one where rational policy making has been basically bullied and terrorised into the pathetic state it is today, where you'd even have, you know, AEMO, whose every expert word we're meant to hang on and rely on as independent, being bullied by the energy minister to change its conclusions to so it fits in with this predilection for gas. I mean, it's literally, you know, I mean, a more responsible minister would have said, that's fine, you publish it, we will then publish our own analysis which says why you're wrong. Okay, fine, that's perfectly right. But to actually try to bully somebody into changing it is outrageous. But, you know, in this world of unaccountability, in this sort of truth deficit environment we're in, people don't care. There's certainly no criticism in most of the media for that.
Mm. Well, I'm afraid that we have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Malcolm Turnbull and Richard Dennis, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much to everyone who joined us on this webinar. I believe there was about 1,400 of us at the peak. We appreciate all your questions, and I'm really sorry we can't always get to all of them.
This has been a special webinar episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel, which you can find at australiainstitute.tv. All our latest research and content is at our website, australiainstitute.org.au, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and this episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and you can find her at Jennifer Macy. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you for listening to Follow the Money, and I hope you're having a great summer.